Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast all about animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. A few weeks ago, we released an episode all about trophy hunting with three Namibian people who know firsthand all about this topic. After seeing the mostly good reaction to this show, I decided I wanted to record a follow-up episode with two more experts on African conservation, Amy Dickman and Professor Adam Hart. We discussed not only the reaction to Into the Wild's episode, but the reaction to the topic altogether, the common patterns we see and some quite problematic stances. I also got the chance to ask Amy and Adam about what they think of charities here in the UK who are campaigning to ban trophy hunting. We also had a Q&A where you guys sent in your questions. Many were quite similar, so I did condense these down into a handful of pretty good questions. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hello to Amy and Adam. Thank you very much for joining me on today's show of Into the Wild, the trophy hunting recap episode. I think that's what I'm going to call it. Thank you very much for joining me. First of all, hello to Amy. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem. For the listeners, can you please explain to us who you are and what is it you do?
My name's Amy Dickman and I'm based at Oxford University, but for most of my career, I've worked out in Africa in the field. And I run a project called the Ruaha Carnivore Project, which is based in southern Tanzania, trying to resolve conflicts between people and large carnivores.
Wow, that's amazing. What's it like working out in that kind of environment in Africa? Is it fun or is it challenging or is it both?
It is definitely both. It's extremely challenging. And certainly at the beginning was very challenging when we had no relationships with the local people and they were very suspicious of conservationists. This is now 10 years we've been working there and really we've had a huge amount of progress. So it's really exciting, but the challenges do still remain.
Thank you so much for joining me. And my second guest is a man that's been on the show before where we were talking more about wasps and spiders, if I remember correctly. That seems many, many months ago. Is Adam Hart. How are you, Adam?
Hi, Ryan. I'm very well, thank you.
For the listeners, even though you've told us once before, but for our new listeners, would you like to explain who you are and what is it you do?
Yeah, sure. I'm Adam Hart. I'm Professor of Science Communication at the University of Gloucestershire, which involves all kinds of bits and pieces. So I'm involved in kind of broadcasting and writing and things. But my scientific interests, away from entomology, which we spoke about before, is African conservation and ecology. So I'm involved in several projects in southern Africa, looking at ecology, looking at conservation management and things like that. And through that and various other bits and pieces, I've become quite involved in the trophy hunting debate over the last 5 years or so.
Amazing. Thank you for being on here again. Now, this chat or this episode as well is an interesting one, I think, because it's kind of a catch-up, I'm finding this, between the three of us based on releasing the episode. The episode we had with Maxi, Lorna and John was, for me, it was so insightful that I came away, my head was buzzing from it. I kind of needed to go for a walk because I needed to walk off that information. But it was lovely to hear from people that were so knowledgeable from experience in this trophy, or as they called it, conservation hunting, which I've tried to use myself. Adam, for you, you saw the release on Twitter and on Instagram. The reaction, how would you describe the reaction to the episode?
Well, mixed, I would say. And it's similar to reactions that I've seen to things that I've done and other bits and pieces that have come out. Actually, quite a lot of people, well, a lot of people don't take any notice of it, of course. A lot of people will engage with it and sort of ask questions and say that they really appreciate hearing that. But then, of course, you always get a small but extraordinarily vocal contingent of people, particularly on Twitter, who will effectively deny what's being said. They're often quite insulting. I think it's fair to say also quite racist in some of the replies there. They're very, very against the information that's been there. And I think we saw all three of those kind of, or at least two of those reactions online. It didn't surprise me. It didn't surprise me we got that. I think most people that, certainly the people that you were engaging with quite early, I noticed very clearly had not listened to the episode at all. And that is an incredibly common thing. Whether it's an article, a broadcast, an interview, it is incredibly common to have people wade in and pull you up, you know, take you to task over it when it's very clear that they haven't actually engaged with the material.
And that's an interesting point. I've got it written down here how many times I asked someone. Where is it? I asked someone 14 times if they'd listened to the episode.
Yeah. It's like that sort of Jerry Paxman Newsnight thing, isn't it, with Michael Howard? You know, you're never getting to the end.
It really was like that, because the points they were asking were good points. Some of them were actually valid questions, and I wasn't bothered by that. But the questions they were asking were answered in the episode. So I was like, if you just take an hour of your day or split it up and listen to the episode, you actually get the answer. Because for me, the point of the show was not necessarily this is to make you be pro conservation hunting, this is to make you be anti conservation hunting. This is for us to sit down and have a chat about it and learn about it and open our minds. It's not about changing. So just dive in and listen. There will be stuff, like Maxie said, there will be parts of it you might not like, but there also might be parts of it where you go, well, I didn't know that happened. And that certainly was the case for me.
It's a big problem, actually. This whole thing is so polarized that you basically, even if, however, in whatever function you end up speaking about it, you have to either be for it or against it. Mm-hmm. And it's a ridiculous thing to be for or against, because, well, what species are we talking about? What populations, what areas, what form of management and so on? It's so complex and nuanced. You can't be for or against it. But of course, that's what particularly social media forces you to become. And I think we saw that developing in the social media kind of conversations you were having afterwards.
And Amy, for yourself, I'm not sure if you saw much of the episode release, but let's talk about this in regards to the actual topic, whenever the topic's discussed as well. The kind of reactions you get, how do you see those reactions come through?
I think, as Adam said, it's an extremely polarised debate, and it's one that seems to really have a lot of sort of hot button topics, because it goes against what people really identify with as their views on wildlife, on animals, on all sorts of things. So it really tends to challenge people. And I certainly have felt that myself. When I first went out to Africa, I was very clear. I was against trophy hunting. I was against all these ways of exploiting animals. And yet when you're living out there and you actually see the realities from the views of the rural communities who are living with them, if you are open-minded, it does force you to really sort of reassess your own beliefs and your own perceptions about this. So I think that, though, has taken me years and years. So it isn't surprising that on social media, one podcast can be met initially with a lot of hostility towards these things. And that's what we see a lot of the times when it comes up, an article or a podcast, something that challenges people is often going to be met initially with a lot of hostility, and then hopefully with a bit of reflection and maybe just the time to think about it and think which of my beliefs actually maybe aren't grounded in fact.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, the beliefs or kind of, I guess some ways as well, the privilege of being able to have an opinion on something but never actually be involved in it, never actually be impacted by that. It's all well and good saying, oh, I believe that's unfair. But, you know, when you live in a completely different country with completely different challenges and completely different lifestyles, it's very easy to have that kind of opinion and say that's not what should be happening. Another thing is, like, what got lost in translation when the episode got, which, you know what, I will take part blame for that, because a lot of people that maybe misunderstood, maybe that was my marketing. Okay, I will hold my hands up there and say maybe I didn't make it clear enough. But we were talking about the Namibian model that's used. And my understanding, Adam, is that the model that's used in Namibia is not necessarily models that are shared throughout Africa.
No, that's right. Or indeed globally, because we're always talking about trophy hunting in the African context, but actually it's a conservation hunting and the use of hunting as a conservation tool is global and particularly significant in places like North America. So yeah, the model that goes on in Namibia, which is the conservancy model predominantly, although there are places that practice hunting which aren't technically conservancies, they're privately owned properties, for example. That model is very different from the model which happened in Botswana and is happening again now in Botswana through sort of hunting concessions, which is more similar to what you might find in Tanzania. And then you've got, of course, the South African model, which is, South Africa is really the main destination for trophy hunting, and certainly for trophy hunting species that are attracting most attention, particularly lions. And the South African model is different again, based on private ownership. And then, of course, you've got the Cutada model in Mozambique. You've got other sort of situations happening in other places. So, yeah, the Namibian model, which is a very successful model and a very interesting model, is only one component of a much more nuanced and subtle and complex pattern. And again, you know, harking back to what I was saying earlier, this idea of trophy hunting being a sort of monolithic activity that you can either, you know, before or against, you know, this whole thing actually reinforces that. You know, are you for or against the conservancy model of Namibia? Are you for and against this concession model, the South African model? You know, all of this stuff is much more complex once you start digging into it. But of course, once you start digging into it, you're forced to then accept the reality that those models work. Because the countries that I've just mentioned are extraordinarily successful countries for conservation. If you throw in Zimbabwe and Zambia in there, you've really got the sort of top countries in the world for large animal conservation all represented. And I think one of the issues that people find is when they start delving into this and trying to make themselves more informed, they are forced into a corner whereby they have to change their opinion, but they don't want to change their opinion because their opinion is held on strong personal, moral and emotional beliefs. And so it almost seems to reinforce that opinion in a weird way. It almost seems like the more they find out about it, the more against the activity they are. And I suspect that is a reaction to the fact that once you delve into this, you really are forced to admit that actually in many places this is the most successful and predominant land use in those areas, and that removing it with no alternative would be a huge problem for them. And I think that is one of the issues that we're facing when we try and communicate this to people.
And I'll say on the podcast now, we're 10 minutes in, so I have to say I'm a vegan. That's the rule. I experienced that. Exactly what you just said is, I don't want to think of an elephant being killed. It upsets me. That's who I am. That's part of my makeup. That's part of the way my brain works. But the experience I went through doing that episode and chatting to Maxi, Lorna and John was going, I'm not going to like the idea of this. But I do like the idea of wild animals striving and being in large populations and managed and working alongside people. I like that idea because that's the planet we all want. So you're absolutely right there. You have to dive in and go, really push past that barrier. It's like running a marathon. You get the stitch. You get that part where you go, I've got to keep going. Go through that bit and put your emotion to one side and kind of listen to it. And that's exactly what I had to do. And I'm not going to speak on behalf of all vegans. I wish I could, but they won't let me in as president. But I think a lot of people do have to kind of step back a little bit and go, this isn't about my views or my feelings at the moment. This is about a logic topic rather than an emotional one. Amy, I want to ask you about, because this is something you kind of have experience on or talking about, is the thought of banning it. This is something that I saw as a reaction on Twitter to just the release of the episode, as people going, it should just be banned. It should just ban it, just get rid of it. Absolutely not, shouldn't exist. That's a damaging thought, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting because I think when you're completely right about the emotions this entire debate brings up, and certainly I'm a vegetarian, I'm a vegan, I would kind of like to be, but you know, cheese and chocolate just still lure me to the dark side. But you know, I went into this whole career because I'm deeply passionate about wildlife and conserving it and having healthy populations of wildlife. My entire career has been focused on reducing wildlife killings. And so it's funny because when people see trophy hunting, they of course say, it just shouldn't happen. I don't want these animals to be killed. But we're not talking about saying you either have trophy hunting or you have these animals live in some utopian universe where they won't be killed. Unfortunately, in trophy hunting areas, if you remove those, as Adam said, without a better alternative put in, and unfortunately, photo tourism, which people often refer to, isn't viable in many of these places. Mm. The likelihood is that you will just not have an economic incentive to maintain wildlife there. And most of my career has been in places where you don't have an economic incentive to keep wildlife. And the amount of killing there in our village and where we work is 100 times higher, up to 100 times higher in some villages than would be allowed if it was a trophy hunting area. And this is devastating killing. It is the killing of cubs. It's the killing of pregnant females. It's horrible killings and snarings and poisonings. So when people say, you know, this is emotional, it's absolutely emotional. And I have cried over the deaths of these lions in the bush. And I don't want to see trophy hunting taken away only to be replaced by far more killing like that in the bush, because that is devastating. People don't recognize that because it's not on social media. It's not covered as much by the national media in any way, but that is the reality. So we need to make sure, rather than just react and say we're going to ban trophy hunting, for a start, it's not our laws to make, but secondly, we have to ensure that if it's taken away, as recommended by the IUCN and others, have to make sure there are viable alternatives there that give at least equal benefits, both in terms of habitat and species conservation and local and revenue to the local communities as well, or we will do more harm than good.
So I suppose it's with the regulation, isn't it? It's something I learned from the episode was how heavily regulated it is in Namibia. And like you said there, you have, I guess, the other side of the coin without conservation hunting is unregulated killing with no real any restrictions at all. And that's something that can't happen. There's a question I asked, and you've just brought this question up in my head when you said then, Amy, about it's not our laws to make. There's a question I asked, and I wanted to ask Maxi, Lorna and John, and I thought I'd ask you two as well, is that charities that we have or organisations over here in the UK or, you know, in other countries as well, in America and stuff, that are trying to push to ban this. Adam, why is that as damaging as it sounds?
Well, the basic situation here is that the organisations that are pushing to ban trophy hunting are doing so really off the back of the emotional connection that people have with animals, and through the very simple conclusion that they'll come to, which you see repeated time and time again, often out of the mouths of celebrities too, that killing is not conservation. And because they have that very simple, clear message, right? Killing is not conservation. Look at these, you know, look at these bastards killing elephants, right? That's their message. This cannot be right. Therefore, it must be banned, right? And that is such a simplistic and powerful message that almost anyone with no knowledge and experience will absolutely get behind it. You know, the damaging thing is that they have such influence and such power. And often, if we're being blunt about this, often I think willfully use misinformation. And at times, I mean, there are clear examples of them lying about the benefits of these and threats sort of this sort of activity. You know, that influence is really pushing through the idea that we should be banning this. And it's almost like you have to now justify why hunting is, it's always like, why should we be doing it? It's like, well, why should you be banning something that's already working? It's never seen in that flip side. And I think that the danger is we see this kind of steamrolling effect potentially going through countries and legislation where people who are doing exactly the sort of conservation that you want on the ground, they are preserving habitat, they're protecting species, very often species that are suffering in other locations. They are doing everything that we demand of them. But actually what we're saying to them now is, because what you're doing is offensive to us because we perhaps don't understand it, or we have a moral position that comes out of privilege, you must stop doing that. So what we're doing then is effectively tying their hands. They're doing what we want them to do, and we're removing tools that allow them to do that. And that to me is very worrying from a conservation perspective. I think it's also worrying from a sort of globalization perspective, and from the perspective of what influence any particular country should have over the activities that go on in other countries, particularly when you can see that those activities are actually doing exactly what they claim. So I think there's some bigger pictures here about how we view global conservation and about the influence both of celebrities and of different countries in those sorts of patterns.
What do you think needs or could or needs to or could change for people to understand conservation hunting better?
Bluntly, they're going there. First time I went to Africa, I thought it was going to look like something out of The Lion King, and I was driving from Malawi to Zambia, and I thought I would be basically, you know, driving through the Serengeti, and I wasn't. I was driving through towns and villages and farmland. I didn't see a single animal. The bird life was very depauperate. Then I arrived at a property in Zambia that did hunting and farming of different forms, and the place was a paradise, and I couldn't work out why. Then I go and spend time in South Africa, and you can stand on the edge of a property, and you can visualize the differences between what's going on inside that property and outside, where management's not going on for wildlife. Once you've actually spent some time on the ground and you've realized some of the complexities, you get this very quickly. I mean, we've had vegan students who are completely against hunting, eating meat within 2 or 3 days of being in the field, because they can see the benefits of the system, they can see and work out why it works, and also they don't like eating meat, they're vegan, because they disagree with intensive farming and really in many respects who doesn't. But when they can see meat being taken in the way that it is there, they no longer have that moral objection. So I think that personal experience is incredibly important, but of course that's a privilege that, you know, some of us have had and most people don't.
Amy, what about yourself? What do you think needs to change for people to understand conservation hunting better?
I think absolutely people need to just to be more open-minded to it and to recognise that almost every situation is more complicated than it first appears. You know, they say every problem is simple from a distance, and that's really true here. I think if anything, the coronavirus pandemic has really shown us how important it is to listen to experts in the field, and to real people with genuine expertise and those on the front lines. I would love to see that more in this kind of debate. So don't just look at a lobbying group that is saying something to a newspaper that prints it in a big, you know, sort of exciting headline. Look beyond that. So just, I think for all of us, we have the responsibility to look beyond the hype. What are the actual facts? And I hope policymakers are doing this, certainly, even if the public are not, to look at what the science shows us and what those people critically on the front line really think of this and how it's affecting their day-to-day lives. And particularly at the moment with the Black Lives Matter movement, there is such a push, as there should be, for better social justice, for more inclusion, but amplifying these voices of like rural Black communities. And that is something that, you know, your podcast was a classic example. It's great to do that. We're talking about it now because those voices were amplified. And that's so, so important that people are willing to listen and willing to look beyond their own prejudices, even if they're not able to have that firsthand experience that Adam talks about.
Absolutely. It's the part of the episode now where we're going to move on to some questions that have been sent in. I will say to my listeners at this point, A, thank you so much if you've emailed, if you've tweeted, if you've Instagrammed us and asked a question and sent it in. It's great to hear from you. The other thing I would like to say is we might not necessarily, or I certainly won't have the answers, but Adam and Amy might not have the answers. Obviously, we don't know what anyone's ever going to ask, and it's always interesting to see what comes through. But we'll do our best and we'll try. So, Amy and Adam, are you ready for some questions?
Always.
Yeah, I think so.
So the first one I got sent in was when, this is more talking about the process of the hunting, which I think is a bit of a shame that people focused on this bit, because that seems to be the smallest part of this big topic, is the actual killing of the animal. It seems to be the smallest part. But nevertheless, when the individual animals are selected, how do people know, or can they be sure that they are hunting the right ones? Adam, would you like to try and answer that?
Yeah, so it depends. I mean, like we said earlier, it's an incredibly variable and complex sort of thing across the board. So it really depends where you are and what sort of species. But for example, if you've got a quota for a particular species, or if you've decided as part of your management to take out a particular individual, what you have to bear in mind is that in many places there will be people on the ground who are able to recognize individual animals or be following them. I mean, that's certainly the case with larger species and sort of the more charismatic species, if you like. So things like elephants, lions, and so on, they may well be specific individuals that are targeted and specific individuals that are tracked. And when you follow a tracker that's skilled on the ground, you realize that they really can pick out an individual and follow them across a tennis court. It's unbelievable what people can do. So there may well be the selection of a specific animal, perhaps an old animal, in some cases an injured animal. So I shadowed a hunt once where someone was going after a hemsbok, so an oryx, as people might call it, that was injured. I mean, it needed to be euthanized, basically, but they were able to follow it from its limping foot pattern and pick up its trail in the morning and sort of close in on it. So it could be that. They may well be looking for particularly old animals. Generally speaking, it's older males that have left breeding herds and so on, sort of out on their own. So that's how the kind of selection goes on. Now, a hunter themselves, it will depend on what they're after. And again, there's a lot of variation. But if hunters are after a particular type of trophy, so some hunters like horns that are very symmetrical and sort of perfect and large, actually a surprisingly large number of hunters like more idiosyncratic horns. So, you know, when they don't quite grow straight, or they're a bit crooked and old and gnarly, particularly with things like buffalo, for example, when you get these very old males, they call them dagger boys, and they're hanging out in the sort of heavy Mapani kind of scrub, and they've got all these kind of scars and sort of weird calluses over their bosses and all this sort of stuff. That's the sort of thing that they might be attracted to. So there is a huge degree of selection that can go on, particularly with these higher value species. So it's not just a case that sort of you go out and see something and you take a pop at it. And there may also be legal regulations as to what time of the year you can take, what the quota is, whether males or females can be taken, and so on. So there's a lot of factors that go into making that decision.
Thank you very much. Another question, Amy, I'll ask you. Has poaching dropped in Namibia since the use of conservation hunting? Is there any kind of stats on that, or is that known?
Well, there's certainly good data that in places like Namibia specifically, the wildlife populations have gone up substantially since they sort of devolved the rights of having wildlife ownership back down to the local landowners. And this is the critical point about it. It's not necessarily about the hunting per se, it's about the devolution of the right to use wildlife down to the local landowners, so that wildlife becomes a resource that is actually an asset, an economic asset to those people, whether they're on a conservancy in Namibia or whether it's a private landowner. Because unless you have, you know, the wildlife being an economic asset, then really it tends to just be something that either competes with your cattle or maybe eats your cattle or is a threat to you, so there's no incentive to keep it around. So because of that devolution of rights, we've definitely seen that the populations in Namibia have gone up. And that's in marked contrast to places like Kenya, for example, where there's been a catastrophic decline in wildlife populations since actually the ban of trophy hunting in 1977. Now, those things aren't necessarily causal. There's many things going on. These are very complex ecosystems. There's human population pressure. There's obviously, you know, climatic change. There's all kinds of things happening. But certainly the evidence is that in places like Zimbabwe and Namibia, for instance, are the only two countries that seem to have growing wild lion populations. And those both use trophy hunting. I know that Namibia calls it conservation hunting. It's not always conservation hunting. It depends on the area. But those are two places that use it as part of that well-regulated wildlife management. Now, that doesn't mean that wherever you use it, it's a panacea. Tanzania also uses it. And Tanzania's had a massive decline in its lion populations. However, those areas where you still have big lion populations, you have large tracts of habitat, these big game reserves, which are set aside for trophy hunting, and big national parks. So it's a complicated picture, but certainly there is good evidence that by protecting the habitat and funding things like anti-poaching, much like with phototourism, trophy hunting and conservation hunting can definitely have, you know, a positive impact in terms of reducing major threats to wildlife.
Thank you. Adam, someone's emailed in and asked what happens with the animal after it's hunted.
It's a very pervasive myth that for some reason these animals are just left to rot in the bush. Anyone that thinks that, I think, has never been to these areas. I know someone whose truck was hit by a kudu, and they've got a tendency to jump, and they can jump into the road, and they do cause accidents. You see cool signs actually warning you about them, the lovely little pictures of them on there. And he got knocked out. He had a collision, got knocked out. He reckoned he was out for about 2 or 3 minutes. By the time he came round, about a third of that kudu was already being removed from the roadside by people that had descended on the accident site. Meat is never left to rot in a bush. I've been present at a number of sort of butchery events after animals have been shot, and generally speaking, everything is used. Even the guts are taken out, they're run through with a hose pipe, and they're hung up to dry and used for all kinds of dishes. Pretty much everything is taken from that carcass. So every scrap of meat, every scrap of usable flesh is used. Then the skin is typically removed, and it really then depends on what the hunter has decided that they want to keep as a trophy. So some hunters will choose to take a skull, in which case the skull is prepared, the meat's removed, and it's left to process generally in a sort of top secret way. Everyone's got their own way of processing bones. And then that will be bleached and sent back, and the hunter will have to pay all the kind of exportation fees and all of the labor fees. If the hunter's decided to keep the skin perhaps as a rug, then that will be scraped and dried and salted, and then it will be sent to a tannery and prepared and then sent overseas. It may be that the hunter's decided to go for a form of mount, so the sort of head on a wall with the skin on, or perhaps a shoulder mount, or what's called a full body mount, where you've got basically the whole animal stuffed. In that case, that needs to go to a very skilled taxidermist. So taxidermists will take the skin, they then prepare that skin and sort of stick it over basically forms. I didn't realize this about taxidermy. It's not sort of the skin stuff full of things. The skin is kind of put over a sort of former that gives it that shape. And taxidermy is itself an incredibly skilled thing. You can very rapidly see the difference between good and bad taxidermy, and good taxidermists have quite a following among the hunter community. So that's what will typically happen. It will all depend on what the hunter wants. It may well be that the hunter doesn't want to take anything as the trophy. If, you know, for them, the experience is what they've come after. They maybe just take a photograph, which of course is one of the big problems on social media when those photographs are shared. And it may be that they don't decide to get anything back. But obviously, if they do, then they're contributing quite a lot of additional money into the local economy, because there'll be sort of trophy fees and export fees and packaging and shipping and perhaps even the preparation of taxidermy, although quite a lot of the taxidermy tends to be done, particularly in the States. So it really depends on the animal, what they want from it and so on. But certainly every scrap of edible meat, from my experience, has always ended up in someone's stomach somewhere.
Amazing. I'll ask you this, Adam, as well. Is someone's emailed in today asking to discuss just Namibia's cheetah trophy hunting. This person is concerned that this particular species is legal to hunt. Now, I don't obviously have any knowledge on this, but could you shed a bit of light on the cheetah trophy hunting?
I think that's probably one that Amy's better qualified to answer than me. Amy, you used to work on cheetahs in Namibia, I think, didn't you?
I did, yes. I worked in Namibia for 6 years, and it was interesting because I turned up there very sort of, you know, wet behind the ears, fresh from the UK, and, you know, horrified that cheetahs were indeed being trophy hunted in these areas. It was interesting that actually, you know, the Cheetah Conservation Fund and all the people there had a very pragmatic view of this. And the more that we went and talked to local landowners, again, the only reason for them having cheetahs there often, the only reason for them tolerating the often quite substantial costs that cheetahs could impose in terms of killing livestock or killing other game, was that occasionally they could trophy hunt a cheetah. So the trophy hunting of cheetahs is not a key threat to the survival of cheetahs, and actually uncontrolled tourism is more of a threat to cheetahs than trophy hunting is. And certainly in places like Namibia, where you've got this, as we've talked about, you know, well-regulated trophy hunting, limited trophy hunting, it is one of the reasons, and because of the habitat protected by that, often in these large conservancy areas, is one of the reasons that Namibia has, you know, the largest free-ranging cheetah population left. And interestingly, when you look at game farms where, for instance, if cheetahs are not able to be taken, and people often say this, they say, you know, I can kind of get behind trophy hunting a little bit for meat and things, but just take away the top predators being on the quotas. But if you do that, the predator has no economic value, and then it's just a cost for those landowners. We found in those situations there was a very high degree of conflict-related killing of cheetahs, far higher than those being taken on trophies. So again, it's slightly more complicated to think about, but counterintuitively, by having a real economic incentive to keep those animals there, you know, gave a real incentive for people to actually conserve them.
Yeah, I'll just add to that as well. I stayed on a farm in Namibia that was actually a cattle, it's a huge property. I had cattle on it, but also lots and lots of wildlife, including cheetahs and hyenas. And when we arrived at the sort of reception, there was a stuffed cheetah there and a stuffed spotted hyena. I got to say that was a little, it wasn't something that made me feel good, right? I don't like seeing that, but I understand some of the background of it. And I started talking to this guy, and he's actually done a huge amount for carnivore conservation on his property, because he's willing to accept the losses. Like he said, most cattle farms will just eradicate them, but actually, because he has a number of clients, particularly from Germany, that will come particularly to hunt hyena, he's got really good hyena populations. I didn't manage to see a live one, unfortunately, but he's got really good hyena populations there that he looks after and has increased because they have a value. And, you know, I said to him, what would happen if trophy hunting was, you know, banned or imports were banned and it went down? And he said, well, you know, I wouldn't actively persecute them, but there would come a point where they would probably no longer be welcome on that land. And, you know, that really just underscored to me just how valuable this is. You know, without the money that he could get from that, you know, this area would have basically cattle on it and whatever birds happen to flit through and some small, you know, probably a few duiker and things, but actually it was teeming. And I think that's really the key thing. When you see that in the flesh, you realize just how important some of these activities can be. And that's why I think, you know, certainly one of the reasons why I tend to be sort of appear to be supporting the activity. I wouldn't suggest that I'm a supporter of trophy hunting, but I do understand its value, and I'm scared and concerned about what might happen if it's removed.
I think that's the key point, really, in that spotted hyena is one of the interesting species. And actually, I'm always quite concerned about spotted hyenas being on quota, because in that case, the largest ones are females, and obviously they're matriarchal, and that can have a lot of damaging impacts if you take away the large females. But similarly, the question, as Adam just mentioned, what would happen if you take these things away? And certainly when you look on village land or on places where large carnivores have no value to most people, you have extensive poisoning, you have snaring, you have very, very indiscriminate killing that not only kills those carnivores, but also kills hundreds of other species as well. So we've had, you know, poisoning incidents where we've had 6 lions killed, but in addition, we've had 80 critically endangered vultures killed, you know, and lions and hyenas and jackals. And the sort of secondary effects you get from poisoning and snaring are actually far bigger than you would get from targeted trophy hunting. So yeah, it does have to be seen in the context of what the alternative is likely to be.
I think that's an amazing, those points you've just made from the animals being, what's the word I'm looking for? You guys used it just now, but like the landowners want to keep the wildlife there because it's incentivized for them to do so. And I think that's a great example of, you know, remembering that we, no matter where we are in the world, we are a part of nature as well. We are living on that land with the wildlife, and it's finding that medium, that balance where wildlife can thrive alongside people as long as it's working for everyone. And I think what I learned from this chat with these from Maxie, Lorna and John is that's what's happening in Namibia, is you've got that balance of people wanting the wildlife to be there, and this is the method to use to make that happen. Amy, there was a question that we got through on Twitter today. I'm going to read it as it came through. This bit was in quotations. I'm not sure where this quote has been taken from. I don't recall it being taken from our show, but it might well have been. We must continue with trophy hunting as there's no viable alternative in many areas. People's lives will be worse off without it. That's the end of the quote. And then their question is, could not same argument be made for the sex industry? If immoral, we must stop it. Discuss, please. Which I mean, it's not what we're talking about, but Amy, what is your response to my question?
That's fine, that's fine. I'm happy to be on social media as an advocate for the sex trade now. no, but I think the real point with this is that whose morality are we talking about? And even with the sex trade, you know, you get very, very different views across the whole world about how, you know, how appropriate it is and how moral it is and how much it should be either regulated and out there openly. You've got places like the Netherlands where it's much more regulated and sort of accessible to people, and other places where it's, you know, viewed as very immoral. I would be incredibly surprised if any country actually didn't have sex trade, but then it was, it's probably much more hidden and sort of unregulated. So I think we have to be very careful to just think, whose morals are we talking about? Because morality is not universal. And I personally think that the morality of those people most affected should hold the most weight and certainly should be listened to at least equally in these debates. So when you're talking about trophy hunting, it shouldn't be someone, as you alluded to earlier on, that just sits in London and thinks this sounds horrible, but they don't have to have send their children to school where there are lions lurking around. They don't have to face the fact that their entire years worth of crops could be destroyed by an elephant in one night. You know, these are very, very serious and moral issues as well. So I think we have to think about how much we are prioritizing animal rights over human rights. And there are very challenging conversations to have there. And these are all things there isn't a clear-cut answer to, but we need to put it out there. We need to be respectful to other people. We need to actively wonder whose morality we're putting first and on what basis. And I think secondly on that point as well is that people often think they want to remove trophy hunting because killing animals is immoral. And as I talked about before, the problem is that if you take it away without better alternatives, in many cases, you will end up with far more wildlife killing. That's certainly what we see. And that means that your morality, your moral basis is stopping animal killing, but actually you end up accelerating it. And that is really not what people want. So we need this to be an informed, respectful and open debate.
Adam, have you got a response to that question that came in as well?
Yeah, I mean, much the same, really. I find this whole question in morality to be quite challenging because it what it generally does is it ends any argument. So quite a classic sort of conversation I might have about this is someone will say, I've heard that trophy hunting is causing extinctions, and you'll say, well, actually there's no evidence for that whatsoever, and in fact, you know, areas where they do it, these animals are increasing, and they go, okay, well, I've heard it's cruel, and you'll sort of talk through the process of natural animal deaths versus the death from a you know, expanding rifle bullet, and they go, okay, fair enough. And then they'll start saying, well, I've heard there's no benefit to the community. And you go, well, actually, that's actually a widely spread held myth as well, although it's very difficult to quantify in some places, and that may be the case in some areas, but it's not the case everywhere. And you sort of talk through the nuance, and you eventually, I know, and I always know where this conversation is going to go, because it always ends up with someone going, yes, but it's immoral. And my response to that is I don't think it is immoral. I don't think it's immoral to kill an animal. I don't. And I don't particularly consider the motivations behind why someone would want to kill an animal. I personally don't hold that to be immoral. And if someone says that they think it's immoral, what they're really saying is that you are immoral, and that really ends the argument. And they sort of think that they have the trump card then, well, it doesn't really matter anything else because it's immoral. And I think that is a big danger with this debate, is that it becomes then even more polarized, because then it's polarized on the basis of I am right and you are wrong, not from an evidentiary basis, but from the basis that I am morally right and therefore you are morally wrong. And that's really very difficult in an issue like this, where there isn't, as Amy says, any clear-cut morality underpinning it. In fact, you know, universal morality is a tricky philosophical concept anyway. So I sometimes think it's a little bit of a red herring. I think it's also, it can be a really good example of false equivalence. We're not talking about, you know, underage prostitutes in the Far East. We're talking about trophy hunting, we're talking about conservation hunting, and we're talking about conservation. It isn't the same thing, but it of course makes for a powerful statement, right? Because the implication, as certainly Amy's had on social media as well, as soon as you start doing this, suddenly you're supporting other activities, and well, if you think this is right, you must think this other thing's right, and it becomes very, very difficult. So I think that whole thing can become a bit of a red herring.
Yeah, I see that a lot. I mean, I see that in the comedian world as well, if I'm completely honest, is that, you know, like we said earlier, if you tweet you like oranges, someone says, well, how dare you, what about lemons? And you're like, well, okay, that's a good point, but not necessarily. I think you can't just, you know, we're discussing one thing at a time. How we end the show on Into the Wild, Adam, as you all know, I usually ask people if they could pass on one bit of advice onto everyone regarding the natural world, what would it be? However, we're going to change it, as I did with Maxi, Lorna and John, and Amy, we'll start with you. If you could just talk to everyone on the planet today about conservation hunting or trophy hunting and kind of feed a bit of advice about it, what would you say to everyone?
I think look behind the immediate headlines that shock you and think long term. And that involves, if you're really thinking about long term conservation, how do we protect intact ecosystems? How do we make sure that we actually deliver, you know, this holistic, you know, conservation for the future? And that's incredibly important, particularly now with the pandemic. We need to have wild spaces. We need to have these big intact ecosystems. And if trophy hunting helps deliver that, then we should potentially be open-minded to the fact that, you know, that it is a conservation tool that certainly shouldn't be thrown out unless we've got better alternatives to replace it with. So think long-term. And the second thing about thinking long-term is making sure that the actual stakeholders affected by that conservation or any mechanism are truly involved and listened to. So that's really, really important that we have to be open-minded and include everyone if we want proper long-term conservation.
Thank you. And Adam, same question to you. What would you pass on to everyone?
Well, conservation is incredibly complex. It's a complex mix of ecology, of human behavior, of economics, of land use, of, you know, we could go on and on and on, right? Complex situations very rarely benefit from simple solutions, and that is certainly the case here. So beware of those offering simple solutions to these situations. They are very rarely, if ever, correct. And I guess the second thing really echoes Amy's, which is that, you know, the mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open. And this is a situation where you really have to have a very open mind. You know, I know my experiences have been, you know, close to 20 years ago now, when I first went to Africa and became exposed to this sort of thing, I was shocked. I had no idea it went on. And, you know, I'd studied conservation at quite a high level at university, and I didn't know about this. It took me quite a long time to work it out. So this is, yeah, it's keep an open mind and always beware of simple solutions.
Amy and Adam, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. It's super important that we keep talking about this and keep diving into it. And it was a wonderful time to chat to Maxie, Lorna and John. It's been great to chat to you both today and kind of have a recap of the topic and the reaction to it. So thank you so much for both being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Amy and Adam are working on, you can do so on Twitter at AdamHartScience and at AmyDickman4. Don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter or intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.